impairment.
Finally.
We continue our educational session with impairments. We're going to TR.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hi. So tomorrow we'll have a joint board meeting on impairment about loan commitments and financial guarantee contract, as well as disclosures. In addition, later on this week, we will have an ISB-only discussion on ISB-only disclosures, about disclosure and presentation of interest revenue on credit impaired financial asset, the application of the model to financial asset reclassified from fair value to profit or loss and transition. Today, at this ed session, we will present paper 5E, loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts. So paper 5E considers if the impairment model should apply to loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts that are not accounted at fair value through profit or loss or as an insurance contract. And if the impairments model should apply, how it should apply. That's the content of paper 5E. Expected losses on loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts are similar to those of loans, and they are typically managed under the same credit risk management approach as loans that are already recognized on the balance sheet. However, existing requirements for recognizing and measuring losses arising from financial guarantee contracts or loan commitments are different from the impairment model. In the ISB-only section of the SD, the ISB invited constituents to comment on whether the proposed impairment model should apply to loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts. As summarized in paragraph 22 and 25 of the paper, most respondents to the SD and in the subsequent outreach that we have done agreed with the proposal to align the impairment requirements for all credit exposures, irrespective of their type, and locate them in a single standard. Others preferred it to stay in the current applicable standards as it's discussed in paragraph 24 and 28. The staff recommends aligning the accounting for loans, loan commitments, and financial guarantee contracts in light of the support of the majority of the respondents and because applying the new impairment model would eliminate purely accounting-driven effects between IAS 37 and IAS 39 or IFRS 9 and would result in a consistent measurement approach irrespective of whether the estimate is made on an individual or on a portfolio basis, as is currently the case under IAS 37. So that's the first issue addressed in paper 5E. Are there any questions?
Questions? Oh, Pat.
I have two questions. Doesn't applying the expected loss model to loan commitments accelerate the day one loss to day one minus 30, 45, whatever the commitment period is? That's my first question. And my second question is, how do you apply the two-bucket model to a loan commitment? Are you looking at, for bucket one, are you looking at the loss event before it goes into bucket one, or the loss event when it goes into bucket one? I'm not sure what the mechanics are.
So in respect to your first question, yes, basically it would bring forward. So you would recognize that 12-month expected loss allowance when you enter into the loan commitment. So before the loan is drawn, before the loan is advanced, basically. And then you would apply the bucket, the impairment model as with loans. So you would assess the likelihood of default of the holder of the loan commitment, and depending on the change, so whether it meets the transfer notion or not, you would then, apply 12 months or lifetime.
So you'd, be up, so you'd look at the reasonably possible test based on if there were cash flows that were due?
Yeah, so yes, correct. If there were, the yes.
Does the 12-month run from the date of commitment or from the date of expected drawdown?
No, it's from the, well... It's from the date of commitment, because essentially you can't avoid being exposed to credit losses. Because, yeah, so it's from the date you enter into the commitment.
Stephen?
So paragraph 12 and your discussion of IS 37, which is, I guess, the alternative. You're saying there that, so paragraph 12b, mm-hmm. saying towards the end, but the measurement of the liability is always based on lifetime expected loss. There's no limitation. But IS 37 doesn't give a day one lifetime loss for loan commitments. And the reason is that it's based upon, it reflects all of the cash flows and the economic benefits. It's a more inclusive calculation. The weakness of the model we're developing for receivables for loans is that it doesn't take into account the benefit you derive from a loan if it doesn't default, which is all the interest income. What we're doing is focusing only on the loss that potentially we will have if it defaults. And of course, when you sign a loan commitment, as long as it's all done at a fair price, there is no day one loss. So IS 37, in a sense, as it's written at the moment, does a better job of getting to the real economics. Is that a fair assessment?
Do you want to be consistent with your model? It's a fair question, right?
Yeah.
So that is clearly, you look at the one-sided view that you have taken throughout. And if you look at losses in isolation, yes, but... I think it's dangerous if you leave this arbitrage open that ultimately the credit risk, just because it's in a commitment form now, you look at the balance of inflows and outflows, and once you're in a loan scenario where actually your inflow perspective is much more significant than you don't. So I can understand what you're getting at, but it is the same thing that we've discussed for many times, in terms of having this day one loss and whether it reflects the economics, so that obviously flows through.
I mean, I agree that there is no reason why we should look at impairment of these things differently from when a credit has actually been advanced. It's mm-hmm. the same economic. But I think this just highlights...
If your question is whether it opens up then a difference to other type of onerous contracts that are not credit risk type onerous contracts, if the credit risk goes that way, but surely that it does. So by aligning it with the rest of the credit risk, you open up the gap with the non-credit type risks. It surely does.
I mean, the criticism of IS 37 is in C, and I would note that had we actually done the modifications to IS 37 that we were proposing some time ago, that problem would have gone away, and that is a weakness of IS 37.
More fix that you can do now.
Yeah.
Amaru?
Thanks. Just a question about, I think the staff is familiar with capital requirement for bank in some aspect. Is this proposal somewhat approximates the concept of capital requirement for loan commitments to the provisioning?
in this issue one.
Yeah. Because as far as I am aware, loan commitments are captured in capital requirements established by the bank regulators.
Yeah.
So now we are going to require provision for these loan commitments.
Yeah. There's certainly consistent thinking in the sense that sort of credit conversion factors are considered by the regulators, at least in some jurisdictions, for these sorts of loan commitments, etc. So in a sense, I think the regulators think about the expected losses in these types of commitments in a similar way to what we're proposing in the paper.
Yeah, and so it's a follow-up maybe. I'm just thinking about in the future that potential react. As far as I know as well, it's this capital requirements are based under the concept of unexpected losses. So in a way that expected losses should be captured by provisioning, by accounting. So a potential outcome of this could be that a revision in capital requirements would be envisaged, because now we are capturing under better, let's say, better mode of provisioning expected losses for this type of commitments and guarantees. I know it's not directly related to the project, but I'm just trying to think
a little bit. In the general direction of movement, it should take some of the concerns away that you have today in those instances where you have this probable threshold included in 37, and that is the one that defers recognition until it becomes probable, and then you have a bigger mismatch between what you describe, and we reduce that mismatch. That is not to say, and I think we said in the paper, that we simply use a kind of regulator-imposed credit conversion factor or something.
Yeah. So I don't
conceptually, you come much closer together.
Yeah, I think we're conceptually, directionally consistent, but I don't think we're proposing a link that's so strong that we get dragged along.
Yeah, I understand that. It's just a potential overlap between concepts in capital requirement and provision here.
But this is actually almost a mirror image of what we have happening with LGD, PD.
Yeah. Exactly.
Bucket one.
Thank you.
BK.
I take the liberty, because this is an education session, so I'm going to ask some stupid question here. Just thinking that loan commitment will have loss recognition when the underlying loan or the potential debtor is getting into financial trouble. Right? That's when I start looking at it. What is the possibility of the loan being drawn down, and what is the possibility of that loan going bad? In that case, will I have three buckets, or will it automatically go into bucket two? I'm just thinking through and saying that.
So if you would move them into the impairment model at initial recognition, so when you enter into the loan commitment, you would establish a 12-month expected loss allowance. And you would basically look at the probability of default and assess whether the transfer notion, so at the likelihood of not collecting your cash flow, so if that is met, then you would move it to bucket 2 or 3 and record lifetime expected losses. So it would apply in the same manner as for loans.
Although I think the question was, could you have a bucket 3, as we have used it sometimes in discussion, although we don't retain anything in that sense, but obviously that is when you get to the stage where it gets drawn.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you could almost say that is the change on a loan commitment that doesn't take you all the way. It takes you to the loan that you wouldn't make at the time anymore, but you have to make it because of the commitment you can't afford. Yeah.
So when that amount is drawn, where would it go? Will it go into bucket 1 on day 1 or bucket 2 right away? Because when the fellow draws down the loan, on the loan commitment, he's already in financial trouble, so would he come into 2 then?
Can I ask the question just maybe as a clarification? From my perspective thinking about this, I thought about the actual event being the granting of the facility. What happens after that is just cash flows.
Exactly.
So it's a little bit like you've got a little bit of an increase in the loan, a little bit of a decrease in the loan. In this case, you've got a big increase in the loan.
Exactly. So I think
but it doesn't change the fact that the classification happens when you've met the test.
Exactly. So I think that if your point is Usually we say when you first recognise a loan, it goes into bucket one. I think the when you first recognise point is when you made the commitment. And then when you draw the cash, that's a later point in time. So when the cash is drawn by your obligor, it could go straight into bucket two or bucket three in the extreme case.
Yeah. It can because go, right?
Because there's been deterioration, you can't jump up.
Yeah.
Because your pricing is so disconnected.
No, I completely agree. I don't think it should go to bucket one. It should go to bucket two. In more cases than not, I would think it goes to bucket two. So I just wanted to be, yeah.
Martin?
I have two questions. And first is, when you calculate an expected loss for a loan commitment, would you take into account also then the probability that the loan is or that the commitment is drawn or not? So, for example, would you say, okay, maybe in my historical data, say, okay, this kind of customer is only 10% probability that the loan is drawn. Will you take that into the calculation of the expected loss, or would you say, no, that is not?
So I think that's the basically the credit conversion factor. So looking at the usage of the facility, so looking at your history in terms of for those types of loan commitments, what is the credit conversion factor? So how much of your undrawn facility will be drawn? So it becomes part of your EAD calculation,
okay,
and therefore it's part of the expected losses.
Yes. That was the first question. Second is, only to think about that, man. I think an expected loss model for cash loans, man, I think it makes sense because, man, you have already factored into the risk, into the interest rate, mm-hmm, what you want to get from your customer. But isn't that different from a commitment? Because, man, with the loans you have, I think, so original model was, okay, to have to match then, okay, interest rate with expected loss. Because in your interest margin you have already factored in the expected loss. That is why you charge a higher interest than the interest risk-free rate. But for commitments, you don't have that. Because, for example, if you say, okay, I will have a loan commitment, you can draw in the next 2 years, but it is often not said in the time of the loan commitment, what is the interest rate then if you draw that loan? Because then it starts, okay, really, when you're receiving interest rates, and then you have not a match between right expected loss and the interest rate.
So
because you can even in a loan commitment, you can say, okay, if, or what I know, because if your credit worthiness will deteriorate, I will not charge you 5%, then I will charge you, if this commitment is drawn, 10%. And then you're starting earn your expected loss when you have really cashed it in, but not before that. A loan commitment is, I think, not the provisioning fees is not really regarding what is the risk of the customer, because the risk of the customer...
Some are based on a matrix or a grid. So in fact, if your credit changes over the course of that loan commitment, it will be captured in the matrix pricing of the grid. That's my
the pricing of the interest rate when this... Yeah, right.
Martin, are you saying you could, in your mind, you could only have an expected loss if you have compensating interest income?
No,
I
think it gets back to Steve's earlier point now,
yes,
by a different route, that it's easier to see how you have the balance between your interest revenue and your cost of bearing losses for a loan, and then for loan commitment, you also have losses, but the overall revenue structure that you try to get is different because you first have a commitment fee structure, and if it gets drawn, you get into a funded loan type fee structure, and obviously you would look at all of that to see whether it's worth doing or not. So, but I think ultimately it's the same point that Stephen had, the uncomfort, so to speak, that you recognize a loss in isolation irrespective of whether it's actually part of a reasonable balance or whether it's a kind of naked loss for which there is no other benefit that you have.
And with the complexity that if you have a revisable interest rate, it would retroact on the probability of the customer drawing the loan. Because if you say, okay, now it's 10%, maybe say, don't take it. I don't think so. There is some interaction with the probability.
You can build it in a very sophisticated way. On the other hand, after the crisis, the banks are also much more looking into the commitment pricing because that might not have included everything that it should have included, arguably.
Stephen?
I had a question on issue four, which is the discount rate. Can we go on to that?
I wanted to go issue
by issue, but...
Oh, right. Okay.
If that's okay.
I'll wait.
Should I?
Cooperate.
You should meet. Okay, so...
Let's go
on.
Yeah, move on,
Anna. Okay, fine. So also, most of the respondents of the supported the proposal. They raised some issues for clarification, and those are the issues that are addressed in issue 2 of 2 to 6 of the paper. So issue 2 addresses which facilities should be included in the scope of the impairment standard. So respondents felt that it's unclear whether the scope would include irrevocable facilities only or also revocable facilities. In addition, the respondents requested clarification on the time horizon that shall be considered when estimating expected credit losses. The paper has two alternatives. Alternative A proposes the contractual maturity approach. So under alternative A, the proposed impairment model would apply to instruments that create a present legal obligation to extend credit. And the period to consider when estimating expected credit losses would be the maximum contractual period. So that means that under alternative A, there only would be irrevocable facilities in the scope, or said in other words, the irrevocable part of a revocable facility, so i.e. the notice period. The time horizon that one would consider when estimating expected credit losses for revolving credit facility, which was a question that respondents addressed or asked us to clarify, would be the notice period and the repayment period. That would be the maximum contractual period over which the entity would be exposed to expected credit losses. However, there's alternative B, and in contrast to alternative A, alternative B considers into the scope of the impairment model all revocable facilities. So all of the revocable facilities would also be included in the scope based on their expected maturity. So that's even if the contractual maturity is longer. Here in alternative B, the impairment model would apply to instruments that behave like a legal obligation to extend credit, and the time horizon is based on the behavior life of the instrument. Despite the complexities that are discussed in paragraph 66, the staff recommends alternative A as it's consistent with the conceptual framework. And it's also consistent, by the way, with the scope of IAS 37 today, what loan commitments are included in IAS 37 today. Are there any questions on issue 2?
No questions.
So, issue 3.
Good.
I just wanted to make up a third alternative, but there's none. So, issue 3. When estimating expected losses for a loan commitment, additional uncertainty arises compared to a loan because the entity needs to estimate future drawdown, which is also referred to as a credit conversion factor. So that's one of the issues that we just addressed with Martin. Response to the SD and constituents during outreach noted that estimating future drawdowns over the lifetime of the instruments introduces additional complexities. And we have considered the alternative that were suggested during the outreach that we've done subsequent to the SD. These suggestions and these alternatives are in paragraph 75 of the memo. All of those alternatives that were suggested are not consistent with the model and would create an exception. Estimating the future drawdowns or the credit conversion factor over the life of the instrument is necessary to have a consistent model. And so the staff doesn't suggest to provide any relief when estimating credit conversion factor over the life of the instrument. Are there any questions in respect to issue 3? Yes.
Question. Is this IESB only?
No, the credit conversion factor is joint. That's a joint discussion. Yes.
Well, at the beginning it had IESB only next to issue 3.
Okay, I'll make sure. No. Yeah. Anyway, it's issue 4 and issue 5. So the next two issues are ISB
on page 9.
Thank you. I'll make sure that's clear tomorrow.
I just had a quick question. Are we going to deal with the disclosures related to these matters elsewhere at some other time?
Didn't think about the commitments. Package.
Do you think there would be anything specific to loan commitments that
wouldn't
be covered by the other disclosures?
Yeah, I guess the point is I understand the mindset of many of the board members here that they like alternative A for purposes of looking at loan commitments and financial commitments, a very legal construct of the definition of a liability. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what I think provides more decision useful information, I think it's very clear that if it's a custom and practice of a bank to always lend on even uncommitted or revocable credit facilities, then I think there should be a disclosure to that effect, okay? And essentially what typically they would expect that credit exposure to be. If in fact they don't, well, that's a different story, but I think that's an important point. That should be clarified in the disclosure.
Could I? Isn't that captured in Jana's answer that you, to someone's question? You will consider the probability of drawdowns.
No,
no. That is the probability of drawdowns within which time period, and this is the probability of drawdown within the maximum contractual maturity of the commitment. Whereas the behaviorized approach would look even further and say, if you have a tendency to roll so that in real terms it stays out longer, then you look also to if it hits you thereafter.
Yeah. Okay. Can I ask you, you know, Amaro, from regulatory point of view, you know, will you consider such kind of possibility?
My former life?
Yeah.
I cannot respond nowadays, because I'm not really updated to regulatory requirements, especially after the crisis. But there are two aspects as well related to that: the cancelable and the non-cancelable loan commitments. This is very much dependent on the country and the type of regulation. There's could be a composition of cancelable and non-cancelable according to capital requirements. This is a sort of incentives, sometimes wrong incentives, that is a result of regulation. I think under the perspective that Pat just mentioned, it could be interesting to have this piece of information, but I believe it would be quite expensive, so for the banks to have these under the on a consolidated basis. So we have to think about that.
And probably need to be aware what that creates in terms of scenario. I think in reality at the moment people sometimes in the actual practice today use more behaviorized, sometimes more the contractual one. And, okay, if you want to move them onto one consistent basis as an objective, well, you can move them contractual or behaviorized. If you now require them to recognize in the financial statements based on contractual and disclosure also behaviorized, you actually now require that this line that they have today is expanded both ways into this full-blown set. Obviously, you can require that, but that creates a lot of estimates that are not made today and would have to be made for the model in the future, sometimes for recognition, sometimes for disclosure purposes.
And to but be I understood just paragraph 58 says that it's consistent with the current Basel II foundation framework. So this is something they do today.
Well, it depends.
So I would disagree that it's extra and ordinary.
If I can clarify that. So the Basel banks, if they're on the advanced approach and if they get their behavioral assumptions audited or approved, then they will use it. But not all banks that are on the advanced approach get them approved.
Agreed.
So in which case they will fall back to what the regulator provides them, in which is more akin to the contractual.
But if in fact you do this, it was the basis of my disclosure. So instead of taking a blanket black and white approach,
but you can
I would
even
say
have,
don't do that.
Okay, so on a consolidated, so in a group, you can have some entities who are doing it on the behavioralized and other entities who are doing it on more of a contractual approach. So as Nathan said, you would then require them to extend doing it both ways for all entities and all loan commitments.
No, I'm saying that to the extent that you have this practice, disclose that. That's what I was saying. So it's an if-then condition. I'm not saying that you have to create two systems.
Is it when you have the practice of actually rolling it, even if you don't have to, which pretty much everybody has, or is it if you compute the statistics that tell you what your loss estimates are based on beyond the contractual term? Two different things.
The former.
The former. So that would basically put in everybody, I think.
Agreed.
Even the regulators.
Then the question is, what is the, if that means everybody pays in plain English.
But this is the practice. That's the point. This is the practice. Instead of using, you know, an accountant's view of the world, let's use an economic view of the world, the way the bank is managed, and report it through the eyes of management. That's what I'm trying to get at here.
I think what you were saying, though, is it's only some banks that do it. So it's not all banks that are doing it.
Well, to the extent they don't, they
Which is why Martin asked the question.
Yeah.
Do you mean those who already do the calculation, which is one thing, or do you mean those who have the practice, which is a much bigger spectrum of things?
And I guess this could be under the disclosure many regulators or even is recommended by Basel related to how capital requirement is calculated by these advanced banks.
Okay. I think either it's a bit of a storm in a teacup. If it's really based on if you produce this number, you'll probably end up that people incorporate a link to their Basel III disclosures because we will allow incorporation by reference. That's a bit of a storm in a teacup. If you require guys who don't have it for that purpose to do it, that's a big storm outside the teacup.
I agree with you. I agree. Yep. No argument.
So we stay in the teacup.
Everything is back in the teacup. That is very good to hear.
Okay, I'll present issue 4 and 5 now together. So issue 4, response requested clarifying what discount rate to use when calculating expected losses for loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts. Some suggested guidance similar to IS 37, so that the rate that should be used should reflect the time value of money and that it's adjusted for risk only if that risk is not reflected in the cash flows being discounted. In the staff's view, that discount rate is appropriate because an EIR notion does not apply for those instruments and expected credit losses need to be discounted to be consistent with the overall impairment model and should reflect that the timing of the cash flows affects its present value. On issue 5, and then I'll open for questions. Issue 5 addresses the accounting for commitment fees and whether that should be considered as part of the impairment project. The staff does not think that changes to the impairment models imply changing the accounting for revenue arising from loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts, especially because we have a decoupled model now. In addition, the discussion of the interaction between the revenue recognition project and revenue arising from financial instruments will decide in which standard the requirements that are currently in IAS 13 will be in the future. That's a discussion that's planned for October 2012 of the revenue team. So I'll stop for questions now for issue 4 and issue 5.
Can I ask?
Okay.
I think... let me go from the backwards. Issue 5, I completely agree with the staff that that's a revenue recognition issue and we need to deal in the revenue recognition project. In the issue 4, I want to ask a question here. Jana, a couple of things I want to ask you in the issue 4. I understand where you're coming from in the guidance that you gave in Para 90, but when it comes to loans, we said we are not going to specify, despite my objection, we said we are not going to specify any rate that needs to be given for the discounting the loan losses, because we said, I think the answer that Sue gave was that, I remember you very well, Susan, there.
Thank you.
That we have two systems. One is the accounting system, another is a risk management system, and they don't talk to each other. And so despite the spiritual and conceptual merits of having the same rate, we said we are not going to specify it. Now, if you specify here a rate or a methodology or whatever you want to call it, suppose I have a loan and I also have a drawdown facility. I have a loan, I have already drawn down on the loan, and I have a loan commitment in addition to the loan. Like I borrowed $1 million, but I have a loan commitment for another $1 million. I'm already in a bad shape. What rate should the bank should use for the loan commitment in that situation?
So for the loan commitment, if it's not drawn down yet, so you would use a risk-free rate, or you would adjust the risk-free rate if you haven't adjusted the cash flows for the risk premium.
And for the loan?
So for the loan, if it's basically in, you know, bucket one, so if you have a 12-month allowance, or in bucket two, a lifetime allowance, so you're not recognized. I come into the conflict with Manuel's paper. If you're recognizing interest revenue on a gross basis, for the losses, you use as a discount rate anything between the risk-free rate and the EIR, so you have this flexibility there for the loan. And that was the issue that Sue addressed, where we need the loss calculation separate, that needs to be able to happen separate from the accounting systems. So that's why we allowed a current rate and we allowed the range, so that somebody can apply a rate that is, you know, closest to the EIR.
From a risk management point of view, would the bank make a distinction between a loan and a loan commitment to use two different rates? Because I am a borrower with already $1 million and I'm already a deadbeat.
Yeah.
And I have another $1 million of loan commitment.
Yeah.
And the way I think I understand you, Jana, is that perhaps there's a potential that the bank has to use two different rates. One is specified by us and another is what bank is using.
Yes.
Is that, does that make sense?
Yeah, if it... Sorry?
Oh. I don't think we specify.
We are specifying here.
I think the same, you know, the previous one, we also say that risk rate plus something, you have a range. I don't think here you so clearly specify something. Also say that, you know, time value of money plus possible risk.
Yeah, but here this relates to liability. So if you also adjust for the risk, it's lower than the risk-free rate. So your upper limit is basically the risk-free rate. Versus when we look at a loan, you're on the asset side, and so then you have the risk-free rate plus something else. So if they don't apply the risk-free rate for their loans, then, you know, obviously there's going to be a different rate for their loans compared to their loan commitments. But I think the key was that they can't,
I'm not a practitioner,
from a risk management perspective, there's a difference because you have funded and unfunded losses, right? For the loan that is already out, you have the funding costs already ticking. For the loan commitment, you still have some costs to be ready to fund if it gets drawn and so on, but it's not the same funding cost as for a drawn loan. So there is a difference mm-hmm. there from a even economic perspective, because the loss is cheap on a commitment that you don't have to fund as long if you get the same cash inflow. You have a higher expense total life. And from an accounting perspective, it does make a difference for the reasons that Jana mentioned. Discounting liabilities is a different thing than discounting assets. We only have this range that people can use from for practical reasons as a direct consequence of decoupling, that you measure a part of an asset still somehow as part of an asset, but on the other hand, you don't want to enforce what we know as the conceptual right discount rate. That results in the decision that you come to. For a loan commitment, there's only one thing to discount here at that stage. So that same logic does not apply. And hence, I do not think that it's inconsistent. It's just a different reaction to different situations that you're in.
We have 7 minutes left. Daryl?
I just want to come in, and I can sort of understand your reply to PK when you're talking about these being two completely different, two separate products. My concern here, and I had a similar concern to PK, is that at least some of the time, this is going to be a case of looking at a single overdraft, for example, an irrevocable overdraft, and the person's drawn down on some of that overdraft. What I'm doing is I'm doing what is the default expectation, and then what is my expected exposure at default. And my expected exposure at default is going to be a higher number. Mm-hmm. And then I would expect normally to be able to apply the same formulas I would just to that higher number. And it seems to me that we're actually going to have to parse that into two pieces, doesn't feel like a natural split.
Yeah.
So I am a little bit concerned about this one as well.
Mm-hmm. Stephen?
Why is this an ISB only issue?
The FASB staff didn't want to address it.
Yeah.
Are they ever going to address it?
It's not on their... when I discussed what issues they still are going to address, it's not on their list of issues.
So how can you measure this without discounting?
Well, when I ask them, they think they should just use the EIR. That was the reply. And in addition, they said... there's no question today about it, so they don't feel it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
I think as a general observation as well, I think they are less focused on discounted cash flows as part of the expected loss calculations generally, so it's made them less focused on discussing discount rates.
Okay, so we won't converge. Second question is about the discount.
One less thing to revisit, so...
on the discount rate, does higher risk mean a higher or lower discount rate? Because if higher risk means a higher discount rate, you get a lower
value
allowance.
Yeah.
Are you talking asset side or liability side?
On the liability
I'm talking about question 4, part B.
Liability side.
The risk specific to the cash flows, et cetera, by adjusting the discount rate. So I'm just asking, is it up or down?
So on this, in this case, it's down. So it's less than the risk-free rate if you adjust the discount rate. And that's because we're on the liability side.
And which economic model gives you the answer?
The same as 37 today, when you have a kind of sole liability.
Okay, that was the
difficult judgment that you
were quite right to say.
Yeah. That's what I said in polite words, yes.
Yes. And one question, I find this discussion a little bit difficult. I mean, we're talking commitments, so there is not any cash drawn already, and then we're discussing time value of money. So I really don't know how this model works. So you have first to estimate, okay, what is the probability then if this commitment is already drawn? And to calculate really this time value of money, you have at which point in time? Because otherwise, I don't know how you should do that. And that indicates for me maybe there is some problem with using the expected loss model for commitments, what I said earlier, because I don't know how people should do that, because there is no cash gone to the customer, but we discussing already, okay, time value of money, but there was no cash involved in that. So I find it a little bit difficult, and maybe there is an indication that maybe that is not the right model for a commitment.
I think it's because we're looking at expectations of cash flows and time. Yeah,
yeah, but you have what you have to.
Yeah.
You have think to about. Think about.
You have to come with the probability. Is it drawn? When it is drawn? And all this kind of stuff.
You have to do that anyway. You have to do that anyway, otherwise you don't know what the amount is. But here the question is, think of it as an extreme scenario, it's only an outflow. The customer draws, walks away, is bust, and you don't recover a single cent. In that case, if that cash outflow is further down in the future, it is less onerous to you than one that is nearer, like any other cash outflow. And that's the only reason why you discount, that you compare different timings of the losses because the cash outflows are at different points in time. Very general concept, that's all.
I understand that.
Yeah.
You should have a
And I think it was a real economic phenomenon during the financial crisis when all these loan commitments to SPVs were drawn.
You mean, can we have the loss 5 years later, please?
Well,
Okay. Generally, I totally agree with the proposal here, but my concern is on the paragraph 55. You know, I'm thinking about the revocable loan commitment. Still in the real world, you are expecting some expected loss. But we are accepting, we are proposing alternative A. So this is a kind of some phenomena happens, but we do not present or disclose anything about that. So I'm just suggesting whether we should consider about the no disclosure about this kind of real.
Losing alliance falling down.
Three United States are aligned.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't.
Well, you can actually use the word that you all carefully try to avoid. It's economic compulsion almost, that you do this for business purposes, you extend this, and then the problem that you only find out too late when you should have withdrawn from the economic compulsion of writing that new business, but you only learn that when you actually have already the disaster that usually happens. When you still can scrap loan commitment, you will do, but...
Yeah. We have...
Based on that, my suggestion was, it looks like this all kind of guidance, maybe. Is it looks like a kind of regulatory requirement rather than financial accounting standards. Because, you know, we have a very general, good general impairment model. So why do we have to, you know, describe every details about this loan commitment or financial guarantee? Yeah, I know this is a kind of special transaction. But we are, you know, describing everything. You know, you should think about the period and cash flows, discount rate, totally separate from the general impairment model. So I'm just considering whether we should put some kind of special consideration to these special maybe transactions. So that's why I'm asking we need some kind, at least some disclosure about some behavioral expected loss of these some revocable facilities. Yeah, that's thank you.
We are through our time. Is there anything left, John?
There's a last issue. It should go quite quickly because it only addresses presentation and their response requested clarification. We recommended that the final standard state explicitly that the expected credit losses of an undrawn loan commitment